begin this evening's talk with a poem that was written a few thousand years ago by a Buddhist nun. And the poem is called Metta. If you develop love truly great, rid of the desire to hold and possess, that strong, clear love, untainted by lust, that love which does not expect to be repaid, that love which is firm but not grasping, enduring but not tied down, gentle and settled, diamond hard but not hurting, helpful but not interfering, cool and refreshing, giving more than taking, dignified but not proud, soft but not weak, that love which leads to enlightenment, then you will be washed of all ill will. And something from Krishnamurti's journal, his meditation journal. When the heart enters into the mind, the mind has quite a different quality. It's really then limitless. It's a sense of living in a vast space where you are part of everything. Meditation is the movement of love. It isn't the love of the one or of the many. It's like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthenware. It's inexhaustible. It's as though the mind enters into itself, beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply until depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases. In this state, there's complete peace. Not contentment, which has come about through gratification, but a peace that has order, beauty, and intensity. It can all be destroyed, as you can destroy a flower. And yet, because of its very vulnerability, it's indestructible. You must begin without knowing anything about it and move from innocence to innocence. The Chinese pictographic writing, in the Chinese pictographic writing, the character for love was developed from two ancient pictographs. The top symbol or pictograph was a very simple one representing a person breathing. A symbol of breath. And the bottom symbol was one for the heart. So, in ancient Chinese pictographic writing, love was written as breath through the heart, breathing through the heart. And the same symbols are used now, only they're not as clear, but historically, that's the development of it, breath through the heart. So when we practice metta, practicing the opening, the expansion of the heart, practicing the towards the capacity of our heart, it's like what happens inside us as the breath moves through us, as breath happens. And we actually can develop a love, as the Buddhist nun said, a love that's truly great, that's not limited, that's not a finite thing, but infinite and spacious. In just one moment of experiencing this, it's very refreshing, really, truly refreshing. And in that moment, we are washed clean. We're purified of all ill will towards all beings, including towards ourselves. One of the Buddhist symbols for loving kindness and compassion is one moon shining in the sky while its image is reflected in 100 bowls of water. The moon doesn't demand that if you open to me, I'll shine on you. It just simply shines in every drop of water on the universe. When it shines. In Tibetan Buddhism, the Buddha of unconditional care, under conditional care and compassion, has a name, Avalokiteshvara. And this Buddha is a figure that's often depicted as having 1,000 arms outstretched, and 1,000 eyes painted, an eye painted in the palm of each hand of these 1,000 arms. The eyes seeing all the suffering in the world, and the arms reaching out to help. Unconditional care and compassion. Quite a number of years ago, I was at a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnamese Buddhist monk and teacher. I'm sure some of you are familiar with him. And there were about 400 adults at this retreat and about 30 children. The children were having their own retreat as we were having ours. Each morning, the children would come in before we started our part of our part of the retreat. The children would come in and do what we call, with young children in school, a show and tell. They would stand up in front of us each morning and show us, and maybe also tell us in words, what they'd been doing in their practice, in their retreat the day before. So one morning, they came in and they stood in a long line in front of us. And they didn't say a word. All they did was hold up their hands. And in each hand, in each palm of each hand, was painted an eye. And they all stood there with their arms stretching out, with eyes in the palms. And then one little boy went up on the platform where Thich Nhat Hanh was sitting and painted an eye in the palm of each of Thich Nhat Hanh's hands. And that was their teaching to us that morning. It was very inspiring, very touching, a really beautiful teaching. No words said. So in this practice of metta, this practice of friendship to ourself, this practice about really being a caring friend to all beings, which includes ourselves. And as probably most of us know, when we experience friendship, when we experience a close friendship with another person, we experience in these deep friendships a respect, a real deep respect and caring coming to us from our friend. We feel a lot of goodwill coming to us from our dear friends. And in a close friendship, an intimate friendship, there's usually not a lot of time dwelling in states of aversion together. They come. They come and they go. But they usually don't last too long because there's a lot of goodwill. They're not so sticky. There's a lot of kindness that's easily accessible to us and to our friend in close friendships. And so even when things are difficult, even when things are unpleasant, they move fairly quickly with a really close, dear friend. Sometimes we think of love with a sentimental kind of feeling. But that actually is not the kind of love we're working with here, that we're talking about, that we're practicing with. Sentimental love actually distorts reality. It's kind of like looking at reality, being in reality, through some kind of a filter. Not really seeing clearly. There's this kind of gauzy filter that we're looking through. Metta, unconditional love, as we're working with it, practicing with it, really cuts through that delusion, that lack of clarity, through the ideas of separation, through the ideas of self and other. And we begin to embrace the whole in an unconditional way. And that's actually the reality. There really is no separation. There really is no duality. Even though we live in duality, we begin to actually experience it with metta, cutting through that separation. And we begin to feel that connection, the truth of the connection. So all of the qualities that we feel in connection with a dear friend are also relevant in our practice with ourselves. Extending kindness, extending patience, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more. Extending those qualities of heart, of mind to ourselves with all of the arising and passing conditions of our body, of our mind, even towards what we think of as our faults, our failings, what we don't like about ourselves, what we think of as our imperfections, what we might label bad or judge as being unacceptable, our bad thoughts, our bad moods, unacceptable because we've been conditioned to think that they're unacceptable. To be able to embrace ourselves wholly. And patience is actually a key to this. Patience is both the seed and the fruit of practice. The Buddha spoke a lot about patience in many different ways, as I think I mentioned last evening. One of the things he said was that there's no higher rule than patience. No nirvana, no freedom higher than forbearance. No greater thing exists, he said, than patience. And in speaking of patience this way, I'd like to explore it a little bit, because I think both in Judaism and Christianity, patience is quite closely linked with suffering. And this isn't what the Buddha was talking about. Patience is, in this way of looking at it, synonymous with love, actually, not suffering. So in using the word forbearance, bearing, forbearing, forbearance, as the highest freedom, it's not meant as a quality of enduring or grim endurance. It's not meant as an attitude of putting up with it, suffering through it, or toughing it out. That's not what it's meant. That's not what's meant by patience. It's really about the quality of softness, of acceptance. We could call it radical acceptance. Patience, forbearance in that sense. Softness and acceptance. The quality of abiding, living in one's life in a way that allows us to approach, allows us to be with, to be fully present with each moment, with a real openness and respect, an honoring of the moment, of ourself in the moment, our experience in the moment, no matter what we're facing in our mind, in our heart, in our body, no matter what's coming to us from the world around us. So patience, forbearance in that sense. It's also spoken about loving-kindness, the practice of loving-kindness, entering into a practice of loving-kindness, beginning such a practice. One of the purposes of it, one of the benefits of it and purposes of it, is that it secludes the heart, or cloisters the heart, protects the heart from the energies of anger, fear, sadness, rage. Subtly, the subtle experiences of those, or the strong, overt experience of those. Those aspects of heart, those aspects of mind. There's a protection that happens as we enter into, and the capacity of our heart begins to grow. We're protected from getting lost, stuck, swept away in states, difficult states of mind. It's a way of introducing our mind, our heart, to this quality of patience that I was talking about. Cultivating our heart towards that quality. and really coming to know in a very deep experiential way, not in an intellectual way, but through our own direct experience, that this is a great advantage. It's a great benefit in our life. With the heart of loving kindness, we're less and less and less inclined to get stuck, to wallow in difficult states of mind, to get like stuck in the mud, to feel sorry for ourselves, self-pity, or sorry, pity for others who might be experiencing difficult emotional states. Pity and compassion are, from this perspective, not the same thing. Pity is a kind of feeling sorry for, rather than the open connection of the compassionate heart. There's a distance in that feeling sorry for. We're also less and less inclined, as the strength of metta grows, to judge ourselves, judge others. And we're also less inclined to obsessively try to find or kind of search out our own weaknesses or other people's weaknesses or what we think of as faults, what we think of as imperfections. They appear or they don't appear. Sometimes, though, we have habits of really looking for those, both in ourselves and in other people. And we also often have the habit of very strong identification with these so-called imperfections. That's who we think we are, often. Or we identify other people through their imperfections. We name them. She's a fearful person. He's a sad person. He's an angry person. And we kind of put them in a box. We do the same thing with ourselves. So this identification with states that really come and go and come and go begins to fade in the light of a loving heart. It's not that we don't see what's happening, but we don't get stuck in or by as often these particular experiences. We begin with metta, with compassion. We begin to see and know these aspects of ourselves, these aspects that of other people, with a kindness, with a kind of spaciousness, with a patient awareness. And so we begin to learn to be with ourselves in ways that sometimes we're more easily able to be with other people. We learn to become a friend to ourselves. There's this Tibetan practice I heard about when I lived in the monastery that I thought was kind of amazing. Very simple practice. For people that are really have such a very incredible, incredibly difficult time giving anything to themselves. And also, in that sense, giving anything to anybody else. Very selfish person, people. So selfish that they're closed to offering themselves any goodness, any love. So the practice is that this person is given something very simple, really, really basic, like a potato. Holding a potato in one hand. And the practice is passing the potato to the other hand. and then passing the potato back again. And you keep passing the potato back and forth until it's easy, until it's just perfectly okay. And then you go on to more, quote, precious things, giving them back and forth to yourself. It was such a practical practice. I thought it was really great. So we begin to learn to be with ourselves, seeing all of the different manifestations of our emotions in our mind, our heart, coming and going and changing. We begin to see them with kindness. And we begin to learn a peaceful but not passive coexistence as fear, sadness, jealousy, anger, doubt, strong desire, wanting, clinging, attachment simply arise and pass, arise and pass, arise and pass. When we practice with an attitude, a real inner attitude of loving kindness and compassion, we then don't create another layer of difficulty, another layer of suffering on top of what's already taking place by being averse to these states of mind. I was doing a 2-month retreat at the Meditation Center in Massachusetts some years ago, and I was feeling, going through a period of very intense loneliness in my practice, in the midst of 99 other people who were in silence, also practicing. I was feeling a sort of excruciating loneliness. And at one point in the midst of this, I was going to go outside and do some walking meditation. My room was up on the second story of the building at one end of a hall, and down at the other end of a hall, of the same hall, was a very good friend of mine who was also in the retreat. So I walked down the hall to go to the stair, the back stairs, to go out the door and go down outside. And as I passed my friend's room down at the far end of the hall, there was a beautiful, there was a vase with a beautiful bunch of flowers sitting by her door that someone had left for her. And I saw those flowers, and raging jealousy arose. I wasn't the least bit happy that they were there for her. I wanted them. What I wanted was the attention that they represented. In my loneliness, I wanted someone to give me the flowers, not her. And so in those moments, I was sort of on fire. You know, jealousy is like a fire. It burns hot. I was on fire with jealousy, and I was hating her. Totally ridiculous. She was a very good friend of mine who I loved a lot. But in that moment, I was kind of consumed, unaware, and in a lot of pain. So I walked down the stairs outside to do metta practice in this fire. And I actually didn't walk down the stairs to do metta practice. I walked down the stairs to just do some mindful walking meditation. But when I got down to the bottom of the stairs, I said, I'm going to do metta practice because I feel awful. And I went, let's see what happens, you know. So I started doing metta practice for my friend. And I started doing it in a particular way, kind of stomping, pounding my feet. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be. And just continued burning with that. And at some point, a light went on, and I said, metta practice for me. That's what I need to do. So I started doing it and kept at it. At first it was not easy, and but I just kept with it and kept with it and kept with it, and slowly there was a softening, and there was an ease of heart, and the fire cooled, and my heart, I could feel my heart again, I could feel my feet again, I could feel the air on my skin again. And at some point it felt like, okay, enough. And I walked back up the stairs. And at the moment I opened the door to come in the hall, into the building, her door was right next to the outside door. She opened her door and saw the flowers. She hadn't seen them yet. And she didn't see me. And her face broke out into this beautiful smile when she saw the flowers. And I just stood there and watched her, and I started, tears just started coming down my face, not in sadness, but in joy. I felt so happy in her delight and the beauty of her delight in the receiving of the flowers. It was quite an amazing change, which I felt really grateful for. So you just never know how practice works. It works in really surprising ways, and when you might least expect it, actually. So we begin our practice with ourself, our moods, our difficult feelings, our beautiful feelings, and not demanding that they not be there. Emotions, sensations, feelings just naturally arise and naturally go away. Struggling with them to get rid of them, fighting with them, actually perpetuates them. We get stuck in them when we try to push them away. In one of the groups today, we were talking about this, and I think of it sometimes as a Velcro practice. As we push, we get stuck. As we push, we get stuck, like that closure of Velcro that sticks on itself. With a close friend, with a good friend, we don't usually demand that they stop feeling whatever it is they're feeling, especially if they're really being honest with us and sharing their experience. We treat them kindly, we listen. We treat them with care. Can we also do this with ourselves? Wisdom arises when we begin to accept all the different beings, both within ourself and outside of ourself. Rather than trying to manipulate things or ignore these beings. I'd like to share a piece of writing with you that comes from a book. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's called The Education of Little Tree. And it's written autobiographical, so it said, about a little boy, Native American, Indian boy, who was brought up by his grandparents. And this is just a short piece from it. Grandma said everybody has two minds. One of the minds has to do with the necessaries of body living, for body living. You had to use it to figure out how to get shelter and eating and such for the body. She said you had to use it to mate and have young'uns and such. Now, this is written in a kind of vernacular. Maybe I'll change some of the words, because I don't know if you'd understand. Young'uns meaning children. She said we had to have that mind so we could carry on. But she said we had another mind that had nothing at all to do with such. She said it was the spirit mind. Grandma said if you use the body living mind to think greedy or mean, if you were always cutting at folks with it and figuring how to profit materially from them, then you would shrink up your spirit mind to the size no bigger than a hickory nut. Grandma said that when your body died, the body living mind died with it. And if that's the way you had thought all of your life, there you were, stuck with a hickory nut spirit. As the spirit mind was all that lived when everything else died. Then Grandma said, when you was born back, as you were bound to be, then there you were, born with a hickory nut spirit that had practically no understanding of anything. Then it might shrink up to the size of a pea and could disappear if the body living mind took over totally. In such case, you lost your spirit completely. That's how you become dead people, Grandma said. Grandma said you could easily spot dead people. She said dead people, when they looked at a woman, saw nothing but dirty. When they looked at other people, they saw nothing but bad. When they looked at a tree, they saw nothing but lumber and profit, never beauty. Grandma said there were dead people walking around. Grandma said that the spirit mind was like any other muscle. If you used it, it got bigger and stronger. She said the only way it could get that way was using it to understand. But you couldn't open the door to it until you quit being greedy and such with your body mind. Then understanding began to happen. And the more you tried to understand, the bigger the spirit mind got. Grandma said understanding and love was the same thing. Except lots of folks went about it backwards too many times, trying to pretend they loved things when they didn't understand them, which can't be done. I see right out that I was going to begin trying to understand practically everybody. For sure, I didn't want to come up with the hickory nut spirit. So in this light, the mirror of relationships, be it our family, our friends, relationships at our work, relationships in our communities, our partner relationships, and relationships in a retreat, even in a silent retreat like this. Relationship is the perfect mirror for practicing, with all of its joys, all of its irritations, all of its annoyances, its frustrations, the dislikes that come up, the likes that arise, the beauty, all that is very apparent in sharing life with others in all different situations in our life. The perfect situation, daily life, retreat life, in relationship, which we're never not, we're always in relationship. The perfect situations for practicing loving kindness, compassion, empathetic, appreciative joy, equanimity. I can truly say that my own children have been and still are really my most powerful teachers, pointing the way towards deeper and deeper understanding of unconditional love, compassion, empathetic joy, and the balance of my heart and my mind. The possibility of learning to be more sensitive and open, to allow each person to be as they are, including ourselves. Working out difficulties rather than trying to force change. Not expecting or pushing another person to be as we want them to be or as we think they should be. But allowing the process to happen. And we can certainly offer our care. We can offer guidance if there's an opening for that. But we can't force change. For instance, with those of us that have children, and mine are grown up now, I could never, ever have imagined how they would grow up, how they would mature. I really had no control over that, as our parents didn't over us. We could never, ever have imagined how our life was going to unfold. In our wildest dreams, we couldn't probably ever have imagined most of the things. We could never have imagined ahead of time most of the things that have happened in our life and continue on, and what will happen. We don't know. So beginning to open, wisdom actually arises when we begin to accept all the different beings, both within ourself and outside of ourself, rather than trying to manipulate things. And we do our best and continue to cultivate the heart in this process of life unfolding through us. There's a really wonderful story about a community in France that the philosopher teacher Gurdjieff had at one time. It was a spiritual community, practicing spiritual community, people who studied and practiced with him. And there was an old man that lived there who was a difficult person. He was not very cooperative. He was messy. He was pretty argumentative. He was, in English we have the word irascible. He was just extremely difficult. And people didn't like him very much. Most of the people didn't like him very much. And he didn't like people very much either. And he was in the community for a while, and he tried to stay there, to stay on, but it was very difficult for him. As it was difficult for others, it was also very difficult for him. And so he left. He went to Paris. He just couldn't stand it anymore. Gurdjieff followed him to Paris and tried to convince him to come back to the community. And the man said, "No, it's too hard. I don't like them. They don't like me. I don't want to be there." He said, "We want you to come back. I want you to come back," is what Gurdjieff said. And Gurdjieff then thought of a good way to do this. He offered the man some money. The man was very, very poor. He couldn't refuse. The man couldn't refuse. So Gurdjieff paid him to come back. And when he returned, everyone in the community was just amazed, aghast, shocked. And then they were even more amazed when they found out that Gurdjieff paid him to come back. They were quite upset. So Gurdjieff called a meeting of everybody, and he listened to all of their stories, their complaints, and then he laughed. And he said, "This man is yeast for the bread. Without him, you would never learn about anger, irritability, patience, compassion, unconditional love, care. That's why you pay me and I pay him." And so he stayed, and everybody learned something. And what about romantic love? Romantic love is often quite conditional. Maybe not always, but quite often. If you do this, if you say this, if you be this way, if you don't do this, if you don't say this, then I'll love you. In romantic love, if someone professes to you that they love you more than themselves, now there's a certain quality of that that's healthy, but there's a certain quality of someone saying they love you more than they love themselves that's really important to pay attention to. Be careful. It actually could be the ground for in our modern language, a very codependent relationship. We lose ourselves in an unhealthy way in that kind of romance, what we think is love, when this is the ground of our relationship. As I've said in lots of different ways over this last day and a half, there's no one either more or less deserving of your love and your care than yourself. Filling the hole of endless need for someone else, or expecting someone else to fill the hole of endless need for you, is actually an endless impossibility. And it's not love. My mother used to tell me that when I was young, she used to tell me fairly often, actually, that you can't really love anybody unless you love yourself. And when I was young, I didn't know what she was talking about. I had no idea. But as I've matured and am maturing, I am beginning to understand what she means, what she wise mother said. I had a student in Poland I mentioned this afternoon, actually, who took one of the metta phrases, "May I love myself completely just as I am in this moment." He took that phrase only as his practice for over a year. He had been a Zen student for about 10 years before he and I met. And in Zen practice, they sometimes the practice is about a question that the teacher asks you that cannot be answered in an ordinary, linear, logical way. It's a question that kind of rattles the brain, shakes up the ordinary way of thinking about and attending to things. So he took this, because of his years of Zen training and working with these kinds of questions with a teacher, he took this phrase, may I be, may I love myself completely just as I am in this moment, as that question. And so he changed the wording. He said, can I love myself completely? He asked himself the question, can I love myself completely just as I am in this moment? And he put that question to himself thousands of times during that year in his daily life and in his sitting practice. He was a man who grew up in a family with a very angry father and a very angry uncle. And as he described it, they were acting out in anger most of the time, and sometimes in harmful physical ways, and certainly verbally a lot. And he learned that because that's what he lived with. So he was an angry man also. He had a lot of easily coming up anger. He had his own business in Poland, very successful businessman, one of the first in that country. And he said he was treated his employees very badly. He was angry at them a lot, treated them in a harsh way. But he didn't like it. As his practice grew and deepened, he really found it wasn't comfortable. He was suffering in that. And so he took this question, can I love myself completely just as I am in this moment? And he would ask it in those moments when he felt anger coming up, when he felt irritation coming up, when he felt all the difficult emotions that he learned so thoroughly from his life as a child in a home with that kind of energy, that he'd ask the question. And he said that in the moment of asking the question, rather than either acting out the anger as he started to feel the energy, becoming more sensitive to it and feeling it actually when it started to come up, or rather than being angry at himself for being angry, he would say, oh, anger, I'm okay. I can love myself in this moment of anger coming up. And then he found often that when that was the relationship, for instance, in his case, to anger, it just kind of dissolved. There wasn't any energy in it anymore. And he was amazed. When I saw him a year later, after this year of practice with this question, there was quite... In this development of our heart, of our human heart, we're actually capable of so much, way more than we can imagine. Our capacity of heart is really beyond anything that we can imagine. My Burmese teacher that I've practiced with, had practiced with for quite a number of years, Upandita, said that this practice is about becoming a real human being. Our capacity as a real human being. As babies, each one of us as babies, In that time of our life, we were totally helpless at some point, totally vulnerable, innocent, completely innocent and open. And most of us have forgotten that in our busyness and our great striving to become someone, to become somebody. And we've also learned to cover over that open quality, a healthy vulnerability to life, and the quality of not knowing, of innocence, we could call it, of being open to how it is. We've learned to protect ourselves and cover that over. And sometimes we needed to learn that. We've needed to learn that in order to survive or to cope with how things were in the past. For some of us, when we were young, we needed to cover over that open, sensitive vulnerability in order to live, actually. Might be that have been that dramatic for some people. But we also learned our lessons so well that it has become our habit of behavior. Even in a maturing life, when that habit of behavior may not be needed anymore and may not be useful, actually, anymore. It actually keeps us, covers over a great deal of our experience and sensitivity to life. It's not so easy to let go of that, of those habits. It's not so easy to relearn different habits. It's not so easy to open up and see life in a more spontaneous, vulnerable way, just as it is at any moment. But for whatever reasons, we've all been drawn to spiritual practice. We're curious, we're looking, we're practicing, because we sense something in that potential of presence, of really being present in open-heartedness with life. Spiritual practice isn't always comfortable, as some, both physically and emotionally, spiritually, as some of you are discovering and have discovered. All kinds of things come up. Spiritual practice, from this perspective, from what is being offered here, it isn't about security in how we usually think of it, how we usually want security. The security of the familiar, the security of the known. Even if that familiar, that known, isn't particularly present, pleasant, or doesn't serve us anymore. It's not about that security. It's about opening to possibilities, which it sometimes feels a little shaky, the unknown. This is a very short piece from another Native American Indian teaching, Cherokee Indians. And it's called From the Cherokee Feast of Days. Autumn. Can there be anything more beautiful than the seasons of a tree? A tree stands in beauty from year to year and keeps its grace and dignity. We learn when we watch a tree. It constantly prunes itself, continually shedding any excess. Nature as a teacher. Our practice is a process of purification, of shedding excess. And it happens very naturally. in a very natural way as we keep engaging in practice, spiritual practice. Our practice is about taking care of ourselves, really truly taking care of ourselves in the deepest ways. And in this opening and open to all parts of our experience as human beings. We open again and again gently in this process of purification. Sometimes I think of practice and the fruits of practice as a process of maturation. That we mature in our practice into what I sometimes think of as a wise baby. We open, very open, vulnerable in a healthy way, very present, but with the understanding of a mature being, like a wise baby. Understanding is the greatest strength. Opening with this strength of wisdom and compassion and unconditional care with a very open-hearted, vulnerable possibility. The liberation of the heart, it's sometimes called. Practice, in some ways, is both the end of innocence and the beginning of it, as we mature into a real human being. And our metta practice can be a great aid in the process. So let's just sit for a couple of moments. This is a poem by a man named Raymond Carver, who wrote it just shortly before he died. And did you get what you wanted in this life? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved. To call myself beloved in this life. Allow ourselves to be dear to ourselves, we actually begin to have that same relationship to other beings. As we care for ourselves in a non-harming way, we are less and less and less inclined to harm others. The metta practice is done by silently repeating particular phrases to ourselves. And I will offer a set of phrases, five or six phrases, and as I offer them, I'll do them slowly one at a time and give you time to silently repeat them to yourself. You don't have to use all the phrases. You can pick just one if that feels appropriate at this point. Or you may choose to use two or all five. You also may find that the wording of the phrases is not quite appropriate for you. You don't really relate in the deepest way to the way that I'm offering them. And so if the phrases change in a natural way and the wording changes so that it actually feels connected to you, to your life at this point in time, that's absolutely okay. And also, I'll be saying them in English, and then I don't know if there's a translation up already. There will be a translation up in Hebrew, because I would imagine for many of you, saying the phrases in Hebrew would be much more meaningful than saying them in English. So please let the process of creativity and truthfulness with yourself be very much alive, so that the phrases that you choose, that you use, are really appropriate for you. So, bringing your attention into the body.
And sitting comfortably. It doesn't mean lounging or having a lazy body, but sitting comfortably with an alert posture. It's important in the metta practice to stay comfortable in your body. We're not using the sensations of the body as our object of attention, although we certainly will be aware of them at different times. So if you find that your attention is distracted by difficult or painful sensations in your body, you can shift just the tiniest bit. Sometimes it just takes a very, very tiny shift in posture to settle in again to a comfortable position. Often sensations arise and pass so quickly that you won't need to shift. Remember to allow your body comfort. It's part of In the metta practice, one of the phrases is, may I take care of myself easily, or happily, or joyfully. So staying comfortable. Relatively comfortable. We'll begin with just a few moments of reflection. Reflection on the question, what do I truly need in order to be happy in this life? There's no right answer. There's no conclusion you need to come to. So letting the question and the inner response to the question just move freely through your heart, through your mind. Thoughts may arise, memories may arise, various hopes and dreams may arise. And just letting it all float freely, holding all the possibilities in the context of the question, what do I truly need in order to be happy in this life? Don't reject or exclude anything. Let it all come and all move through. And remaining honest with yourself throughout the flow of reflection. Remembering that the conditional and the very fleeting happiness isn't really our highest potential. All objects, all people, and every single situation changes. So looking for a kind of unchanging happiness or contentment there, it isn't what that offers. What do I truly need to be happy in this world?